Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Hey friends, welcome back to the show. I recorded this a couple weeks ago with one of my favorite people in the world, Randy Harris. I think you're really going to enjoy it, even though a few of the comments are a little bit out of order because, like I said, it was recorded a couple weeks ago. But I think you're going to really enjoy it. If you got questions, comments, or anything, hit me up, luke@lukenorisworthy.com or on Twitter @lukenorisworthy. Thanks again for listening. Here he is, Randy Harris. Welcome back to the show. Today we are live in person with my good friend, Randy Harris. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you.
There's a big change in your life. You're not going all black anymore.
That's true.
You are very, earth tone-y colorful.
Yes.
You used to be all black as a way of simplifying your life, for simplicity.
Yes.
And now you are for clutter.
No, I'm not for clutter, but there is a reason for the change, but I haven't shared it with anybody yet.
Yeah, so this would be a great time
to
share it.
This is an excellent venue, but I'm not quite ready yet. So
when you are ready, will you promise to come on the show and tell everyone?
I will tell you. Yes.
We have that. It's
yes.
You know what? One of the important virtues of someone who is a decent Samaritan is promise keeping.
I know.
So you have to come on the show and say it now.
I will do that.
Yeah. Now,
when it's time.
Okay. You've got a trip coming up to Singapore next week.
Yes.
You know, my last guest had just gotten back from Singapore.
Mm-hmm. Singapore is a great place to visit. It's lots of different cultures. As you know, it's got this reputation of being this regimented, very well-run city. So I don't know what it'd be like to live there, but for a visitor, and a lot of great friends there. And I love to eat in Singapore.
What do you like to eat in Singapore?
I really like the Indian food, but they also have Malay, of course, and Chinese, and just all varieties of food. You can eat anything in
Singapore. Really? Do they have P.F. Chang's there?
I wouldn't doubt it, although I don't remember a P.F. Chang's, but there's a lot of Western chains in Singapore.
Wait, that's West? That's American? That's not? I thought it came over.
I have no idea.
No, I guess not. That's good. And you just got back from Ireland, which our guest before is from Ireland.
Yeah.
So we're making this a very international feel right here, aren't we?
There you go. Had a great time in Ireland. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Along with Abilene.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the great thing about living in Abilene. No matter where you go, it looks good.
Oh, that's great. Well, you've got a new book that came out. How long ago did it come out?
May.
May? Mm-hmm. Yours came out the same time Stormont's came out, right?
Correct.
It was officially dropped at Pepperdine.
Correct.
And it's since kind of been dispersed as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Can I tell you something? I am awful with book titles.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember book titles at all.
Mm-hmm. This one's called Life Work.
Before that, it was
Soul Work.
You like the work theme.
Yeah. This is the third book in a trilogy. Mm-hmm. I did God Work, Soul Work, and Life Work. And it is a trilogy. There is no fourth coming.
I was trying to figure out what you could do next. No. Seems like you've kind of...
And then squeezed in between the last two, I had the Living Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount.
The Sermon on the Mount stuff, yeah.
Which was a different thing, yeah.
Did you enjoy writing the series?
I did. These are basically a reworking of lectures that I've done over the last decade or so at Pepperdine and other lecture venues and churches and that sort of thing. So this is basically most of the things I've tried to say to people over the last decade or 15 years or so.
Yeah, I remember reading the first one or second one and going, I've heard Randy say this, I've heard this one before. Yep. So, yeah, these are the best of Randy Harris.
For what it is, yes.
Yeah, so you start off with a bunch of ethical dilemmas to start the book, which are really fascinating. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Which one was your favorite one? What's your go-to ethical dilemma that you give to people?
Well, I think the because it has such a rich history, the trolley dilemma is my favorite dilemma.
And that's the one where – are you just going to say it?
Well, there are actually now probably a dozen variations on the trolley dilemma.
Okay.
Some people call it trolleyology.
Trolleyology?
Yes, because ethics professors have done so much with this one little dilemma. But, you know, the basic dilemma is a trolley is coming down the track and it is going to run over five people who are tied to the track.
Mm-hmm.
But you are standing by a switch where if you flip the switch, it will be diverted and so it won't run over the five people, but it will kill one person who's down on the track to which you would switch it.
Do you get to pick the five and the one who those people are?
You don't in this version of the of the trolley dilemma. And so the question is, do you do nothing and let the five die? Or do you take positive action, which will surely kill the one? And in which case, you know, you're clearly responsible for the death of the
one. You caused that one.
The one. You caused that one. Yeah.
So the right answer is what?
it doesn't quite work that way, does it?
What?
Most people, you know, through the years, the trolleyologists will say, most people would say they would flip the switch and
take the one,
divert the train.
Yeah. Now, that would be a utilitarian
right
approach to ethics?
Absolutely. Sacrifice the one for the sake of the five. Okay, but that's where it gets interesting, because then you pose another dilemma. All right. Suppose you're standing on an overpass that goes over the track. And same thing, five people tied, mm-hmm. the train is going down there. But now you have this large person standing beside you. It's called the fat man dilemma. Okay, so you have this fat man standing beside you, and he's glancing over. And if you give him just a little push,
he
will fall on the track, and his bulk will stop the trolley from killing the five people, but he will certainly be killed. And you can't jump off in front of the trolley because you're not big enough. It has to be something really large. And so then the question is, would you be willing to push the fat man off the overpass in order to save the five?
And you don't get to pick which of your friends is that person, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So totally innocent bystander. Now, the interesting thing about this is most people will say no to that. And the same people who said they were willing to pull the switch now won't push the fat man. So what we are puzzled by as ethicists is, what's the difference in those two scenarios? Because they look exactly the same, and yet people don't react to them the same way.
Why is that?
Lots of theories.
Give me the best one.
I think the best theory is that ethics is never just about hard, calculating reason. And that proximity makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about just the action of pushing the person that creates emotion and reticence in us that flipping the switch doesn't.
That's cold and calculated. If you flip the switch,
sure.
You're actually pushing someone. Your hands are on another
human being. You're engaged in that.
You're just manipulating a machine with the tracks.
Yeah, but one could certainly argue they're the same action. You know that either way they're the same thing, but people don't experience them as the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that tells us is, in their ethical lives, people aren't just calculating machines. There are all sorts of other things that get involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And as an ethicist, you have to take that into consideration.
Yeah.
And there are just probably, a half dozen to a dozen more variations on the trolley dilemma, again, sort of exploring how it is that we actually think about right and wrong.
So. Yeah. And so that's where you come up with the type of ethics which you believe you ascribe to, which is pluralistic, and you said the second word. So
pluralistic deontology.
Deontology.
And deontology it goes back to for your listeners who do philosophy, they'll know this. Goes back to Immanuel Kant, and it is about duty.
Okay.
So a deontologist, simple definition, is a deontologist believes that certain things are right or wrong, regardless of their consequences. So a utilitarian is always going to calculate right or wrong based on the consequences, but a deontologist says some things are right or wrong regardless of the consequences.
And so when you were using what you called the 24 dilemma, which is basically torture terrorist, save the city, don't torture the terrorist, city dies.
Right.
A utilitarian is going to say, well, obviously you're going to do that because it saves more people, and obviously you know, torturing people, not something you probably should do very often.
Right.
Or maybe ever.
Right.
Probably ever. But the ends justify that.
Correct.
Whereas the school of thought that comes from my friend Immanuel Kant says, wait a minute, is that...
It's always wrong.
It's always wrong.
Right.
Now, one of the things that you didn't talk about when you were talking about the 24 dilemma was what is deserved and blame.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, someone might argue and say, well, the terrorist deserves that. If you can prove without a shadow of a doubt they have done this to other people, then there's blood already on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
That's never part of the discussion. Why do you think that wasn't included as we're going through that dilemma? Or is it usually discussed...
Yeah, at least when I discuss it with my students, it comes up.
Okay.
Because I always present them with the next piece of the dilemma is, okay, supposing that the terrorist turns out to be a really hard nut to crack, and you have also acquired his 8-year-old son, would you be willing to torture his 8-year-old son in front of him in order to get him to tell where the dirty bomb is?
Now, since you don't watch 24, I'll fill you in what happens, because we've talked about Jack Brown's podcast,
okay.
And in this situation, he convinces the terrorist that he actually is putting the terrorist's son down the disposal, but really, it's just the stake that he put down there, and
yeah.
It looks like it.
Yeah. Well,
is that an option?
Our particular terrorist is not as stupid as that.
But it was on TV.
I understand that, but the only way you're going to convince this terrorist is that you're torturing his son is by... torturing his son.
Okay.
And most of my students will say, yes, you should torture the terrorist and save hundreds of thousands of people, including infants and children. And then when I ask them about torturing the terrorist's son, they jump overboard, where the calculation is exactly the same. The discomfort of one person versus all of these lives. But they don't react to it the same way, which means that they're bringing in the question of dessert.
The blame.
Is getting what he deserves, but the kid isn't. So you're not allowed to do that. One of the things you have to watch for is some people who appear to be totally utilitarian in their thinking. If you just change the dilemma a little bit, all of a sudden quit thinking like utilitarians, and other things come into play.
Yeah. Well, you make the bold statement that if the consequences are high enough, most people and their integrity is for sale.
Yes.
Right? Which is a very nice thing to say. Now, which brings me to my own ethical dilemma. I don't know if you've ever heard this one before, but I want you to answer my ethical... Okay. So if you had to choose between being the richest person in the world or creating world peace, what color would your Lamborghini be? Everyone would say we want peace, but really the consequences are pretty high. I don't want to do that, which is why you argue for a different type of ethics, which is virtue ethics. What does that mean?
I'm not quite a virtue ethicist, by the way, just to get that straight, but I'm a deontologist, and those aren't the same thing. Okay. But a virtue ethicist would say the real question is not what would you do. The question is what kind of person are you?
Okay.
So the emphasis here is not on the particular action. The emphasis is on the quality of character.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about virtue ethics is 95% of the time it works great. You know, we just ask the question, okay, what kind of person do you want to be?
Yeah.
What kind of values do you hold? The disadvantage of virtue ethics is it gives you no way to solve dilemmas.
Hmm.
Because what virtue ethics is basically going to tell you to do is do the right thing, do the loving thing, do the thing that is consistent with your high character.
And that doesn't answer the train or the trolley.
Correct. When we come to those kind of questions, like, well, that's my problem. I don't know what the right thing to do is. So I really like virtue ethics because it addresses most of what we think of as the moral life.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't help very much when we're trying to solve dilemmas. It doesn't even have any principles by which we can solve dilemmas.
So how do we do that?
Well, I think if you're in a dilemma, you've got to kick into a different kind of ethical reflection, something other than...
Yeah.
I mean, a long time ago, Augustine basically said, love and do what you will. couple of thousand years after that, a guy named Fletcher, Joseph Fletcher, he became famous because of what was called situation ethics.
Okay.
And Joe Fletcher basically said the same thing. He just recycled Augustine. He says, just do the loving thing.
Uh-huh.
And everybody reacted. So there's no principles here. It's totally relativistic.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem with Joe Fletcher's theory is not that it's relativistic. The problem is this is not helpful. In those cases where you get to the point where your question is, what is the loving thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when I have this loved one who is dying and suffering, and I have to make the decision of whether I'm going to short-circuit their suffering by overdosing them mm-hmm. with a drug, the question is not, am I going to act in a loving manner? I am. The question is, okay, what's the loving thing to do here?
Yeah.
Is the loving thing to do to kill them? Or is the loving thing to do to stand beside them as they go through this period of suffering? And so I'm a great believer in the virtue of love, and I think do the loving thing addresses a lot of the moral life. But there are points at which that's precisely our question. Yeah, I want to act in a loving way. I just don't know what the loving thing to do is.
So, for those of us who are going, well, give me the answer. What am I supposed to do? Are you saying there really isn't an answer?
Well, I think, I think there probably is an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too optimistic about human beings to always be able to figure out what that is. I mean, those are two different things. One is a more of a metaphysical question. Is there a truth on this matter? Well, my guess is there probably is.
Okay.
The other is what we might think of as an epistemological question. Can I figure out what that is? And in some cases, I may be genuinely puzzled. I think that now I would be sort of echoing one of the Niebuhrs here. I think what
one of your neighbors?
Niebuhrs, as in Reinhold.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were saying your neighbors.
All those kind of guys.
Okay. Yeah,
all these Niebuhrs, yeah. That what we need is a responsible self.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we need a reflective, caring, engaged self.
Okay.
And so what I actually do is I give my students, a way to think through ethical dilemmas. And from my point of view, that's the best you can do.
Hmm.
You have this process, you think it through, and then you do the best. You do the best you can.
Do the best you can.
Yeah. By the way, there is a rising mountain of evidence that shows that ethics classes has very little impact on people's behavior.
How does that make you feel, someone who teaches those classes?
Oh, useless. What the evidence shows is what ethics classes mostly do is help people argue their positions better.
Mm-hmm.
So they come into my ethics class, they've got a point of view, but they don't really know how to defend it. By the time they're through with my class, they really haven't changed their point of view, but now they know how to defend it. That's the most common outcomes of ethics classes.
You were in Scotland, didn't you just stop by and see old Hume, and wouldn't he tell you the same thing?
I wasn't in Scotland. I was in Ireland.
Same thing. Sorry, Pete. Okay, so let's transition to something else. You have this line that the primary story out of which we work is fear and power. The two primary stories are fear and power.
Mm-hmm.
What are some examples of ways that people are operating out of? Let's just start with fear.
Yeah. Okay, first of all, that's the same story, the story of fear and power.
Okay.
It's the same.
Oh, that's the same thing?
It's the same story.
Yeah. Fear and power are the same thing?
The story of fear and power is
okay,
the same
thing. How is that the same thing?
Because when I'm afraid, what I try to do is I try to get control.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the way I deal with my fear. Okay, so if I'm afraid, then what I need to do is acquire power.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you a Malcolm Gladwell fan?
A what fan?
Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes.
Okay,
I
heard him talking about the newspaper industry, and he was talking about how newspaper industries are very siloed, and if you're a business guy, you're at business. If you're weather, if you're sports, you stay in your things. And he says as the newspaper industry dwindles, they're becoming more conservative about these silos instead of being more willing to think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
He says that's part of the problem is when things go bad, you start to get more conservative.
Right.
Same idea.
Yeah. And so let's think about it in a couple of different cases. Let's think about politics first. Regardless of what your political party is, your basic platform always has to be the same. You should be afraid.
Of the other side.
Absolutely. You should be very afraid. And, you know, if you elect the other side, there's going to be chaos in the streets and war, mm-hmm. and the economy is going to go down. It's the politics of fear. And the way you deal with that fear is our side gets control, mm-hmm. claims power. Okay, so that's easy for us to see. Okay, so let's think about churches. You know, the late Dallas Willard was very big on saying to preachers, the most important spiritual discipline for you is to pray for all of the churches around you. Mm-hmm. Because he knows that ministers basically work out of fear and power. Hmm. Their deepest fear is this church, which has been here 100 years, is going to go down on my watch. Mm-hmm. That's what they're really afraid of. And so their reaction to that is to try to control and get bigger or more successful or more viable, mm-hmm. In any way they have to. And so they're constantly working out of this story of fear and power. And I would argue it's the ancient story. It's the story of the garden where Adam and Eve don't want to have to rely on God. They want to be the source of their own security. And so their fear leads them to try to grab power. And so fear and power is what has led our world to the brink of utter destruction. Mm-hmm. It's how we're almost destroying ourselves. It makes us miserable, and it is the dominant. It's the dominant story of our time.
So, if that's the kingdom of the world, how does the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, have a voice to that? How does the kingdom of heaven change that?
Yeah, the opposing story, I've argued in the book, is cruciformity, or being cross-shaped. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus, for instance, in Philippians 2, is said not to have counted his equality with God as something to be greedily held on to, but mm-hmm. emptied himself in the original language. Okay, so rather than grasping power, he gives it up. Mm-hmm. And God's primary revelation of himself in Scripture is not through an act of power, it's through an act of powerlessness. So, you know, in the religious heritage we come from, we have this old hymn where Jesus on the cross, and it says he could have called 10,000 angels mm-hmm. to destroy the world, but he didn't.
Is that good theology?
It's great theology.
How's it? It's math.
It's bad math.
Bad math.
It's bad math, yeah. It doesn't take 10,000 angels. It just takes one. they're very powerful. But the theology is excellent. I mean,
he could have,
and God intentionally decides to redeem the world not with power but with self-giving, self-sacrificial mm-hmm. love. And so the task of the church is to counter the story of fear and power with the story of cruciformity, which is very hard if you're a church operating out of the story of fear and power. Power. And that story is so all-pervasive. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't have any hope that we're going to constantly live in the cruciform story. I would just hope that we would learn to live in it a little more often.
There we are right now.
Yes, and become aware when we're not.
Hmm. You quote, I'm not going to say his name right. What is the guy who wrote Pieces Every Step?
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, I was going to completely botch that, so I was going to let you say that one. Okay, so you make a quote to him that, you know, the kingdom of heaven is inside of us right now, mm-hmm. and everything we need is already there.
Yes.
How do we live out of that instead of the fear of power, or the fear and power story?
Again, Dallas Willard, who would be my primary teacher on this, would say that it's by practice that you find out that God can be trusted. In his last book, he's got this very provocative line where he says, if you can find a better way than Jesus' way, then Jesus would tell you to take it. So he actually believes that in the process of following Jesus, that God comes to meet you there, mm-hmm. and you experience this kind of peace, joy, and love in that process that you wouldn't want to trade in for anything else. And I do think there's something right about that. A cruciformity is not a theory. Cruciformity is something you live into, and you find out the truth about it in engaging.
So are you saying when there's an opportunity for me to choose the way of power and fear or the way of the kingdom of heaven, I choose the kingdom of heaven, and in that I experience, okay, this is good news, and so I want to stay in this.
I think every time you make that choice, the choice is easier to make the next time. And every time you fail to make that choice, the choice is harder to make the next time.
Okay, so give someone an example. So we're trying to imagine a time in which we had the choice between the way of fear and power or the way of the kingdom. What does that look like? I mean, give me an example.
Yeah, I think that's actually harder, but I think, how do you behave yourself in a meeting? Is a meeting a way that you, in a calculating, manipulative way, always try to get your own way? Or is a meeting the place where you say, okay, what does God want to happen for the kingdom here? And rather than just being an exercise in the manipulation of group dynamics, mm-hmm. it becomes the occasion for opening yourself up to the movements of the Holy Spirit and the kingdom of God.
But what if you think your ideas are the best for the kingdom?
You always do.
As in me, Luke, because I'm your student and we've known each other for a long time and I'm smart?
No, everybody.
Oh, okay.
Okay, the reason you hold a view is because you think it's the
best way.
Right view or best view.
So when I think I've got the best way, I shouldn't think that's a unique thing that only I have?
Correct. Everybody always has that view all the time.
I don't like that. I like to think that I have moment of...
Yeah. And so I think... being open to the possibility that I may not be right, mm-hmm. or being open to the possibility that it may not matter whether I'm right or not. That allows us a freedom that we don't experience otherwise.
Yeah. Okay. So what if I'm trying to say I want to trust the way of God over the way of power and control, but I've read my Bible. I've seen how it's worked out for Israel. Like, God took care of them, but I'm probably a bigger fan of, like, middle-class America suburban way of life. Far more comfortable than, say, like, being in the desert.
Right.
What if I'm trying to convince God that this really is probably the better way, and he might not agree with that? Mm. And how can I make sure that I can keep my quality of life while also having the kingdom of heaven? Can we make that happen?
I think that imagining living in the kingdom of God without risk doesn't make any sense.
Why is risk such a big deal?
Because risk says that I'm going to trust something other than my own brilliance, willfulness, and ability.
What else am I going to trust besides my ingenuity?
God.
God?
Yeah.
Okay, so you made the example in your book about Jesus didn't raise himself out of the grave.
Right.
Is that true? We have,
I think so.
You're sure of that? And so for 3 days, where did he go for those 3 days, by the way, before God raised him out?
The Christian tradition says he went to hell.
Okay, where does the Harris tradition say he went?
I don't see any reason to question the Christian tradition on that.
Okay, so the two are the same on this one?
Yeah.
Okay, so Jesus, 3 days... Once I was at basketball practice when I was like 10 years old, and my dad was supposed to pick me up, and I called him after practice because I've been waiting there for 2 hours, and he's playing video games with my brother. And so I call him, and I say, Dad, and his first response is, who is this? That really happened, okay? I'm living in West Philadelphia, playing basketball, and that's why I hate basketball to this day. That's why I became a wrestler. Okay, Jesus waiting for 3 days. That's a long time in Hades or hell. I've never been there. Yeah. My air conditioner went out last night, and one night without an air conditioner in Texas felt like hell.
Go on.
So God seems to wait, and his timing is not always my timing. And I don't want to wait 2 hours for my dad. I don't want to wait one day without air conditioning. If I have to wait on God, then I've got to go with his timing.
Right.
How do I do that?
It's actually surprising when you start looking for it, how often that one comes up. The question that gets asked in Scripture a lot is not always why. The question that gets asked is when. or how mm-hmm. long?
How long the Lord must we wait? Yeah.
And so, okay, so you're dealing with this God who has no sense of time, and it's a genuine problem. This yes. willingness to wait. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any easy solution to that other than there was a resurrection, mm-hmm. and you know Jesus becomes for us the ultimate example of the one who trusts so completely and freely in God that he'll risk hell because he has such confidence that his Father will not abandon him. Mm-hmm. But I do think that's the work of the Spirit, right? Right. You can't just kind of snap your fingers and say, okay, now I'm gonna do that.
Okay.
I think that kind of confidence and trust in God is a God-given gift. But I think you have to lean into it. You have to put yourself in a position to trust God.
When you say lean into it, what does that look like to lean into that?
I think it is in those moments to intentionally make the decision towards Christ-likeness, towards cruciformity.
So I'm struggling with, you know, do I domineer this thing or do I trust, okay, I trust God, you're bigger than this, I trust in your timing, I trust mm-hmm. in you, and so that's just making the choice, I'm not there right now, but yep. I'm gonna try to get there?
And I think that creates space for God.
Really? How does it create space?
I think that willingness to say yes to the Spirit in that moment. Let's God have a little more room and sway in your heart, which is why, at least as I talk to my students, it's not like the small decisions aren't important, because out of those small decisions come the, you know, the big ones. If you hit the big ones without ever having leaned into any of the small ones, I think it's really hard.
Yeah.
To do.
Have you read the book Willpower?
Yes.
Okay. So Baumeister, is that the name?
I don't remember.
I think it's a Florida State psychologist, yeah. psychiatrist, and he talks about David Blaine when he's preparing to do his big. He's the illusionist, magician, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's like the politically correct term for that. I don't know what it yeah. is. I feel like I'm going to offend yeah. like the group.
All the magicians.
Yeah. There. There's going to be like a group of magicians who boycott my show because of this. But like when he's training to do one of these big performances, he becomes so disciplined in everything he does to the point where he won't like step on cracks, and his diet becomes like a professional athlete, and he's exercising, and all these small steps enable him to do the ridiculous, like, you know, live in a box for 4 months or whatever he does.
Right.
But all the little things create some sort of ability to do the big thing. And that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. And there's kind of, I mean, we don't particularly want to get into this book, but there are kind of two things in the book. There's that, and then there's the other side of it that says willpower is not a
unlimited
reserve, and so you got to kind of pick your battles.
Yeah, I don't talk to my wife after 11 because I'm just a terrible person.
Yeah.
In the morning I'm fine, but
yeah, and I think and I want to be. I get the point that it's the discipline of the little things that gives us some leverage in the big things. I think that's absolutely true. But the transformed life is not an act of just willpower.
Really? How so? Tell me.
I think it's the movement of God, that God doesn't just call, he empowers. And
I'm not trying to lean into so I learn how to always take the choice of God, but somehow in that God is working in me too?
Correct.
Okay.
And that... You're giving God greater sway, greater power in your life.
So there's some sort of dance between I am making the choice, but God is also in me.
This is the dance of the whole Christian tradition. Mm. That one thing the tradition says is there's absolutely nothing you can do. It's all God.
Yeah.
And then the tradition comes back and says, oh, by the way, there's some things you can do that make yourself accessible or available to God.
And which one's right?
Yes.
Yeah. Nice.
I mean, that's the great thing about the tradition is it says both things. Mm-hmm. And it recognizes the tension in those things as it's saying them.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I'm going to say the transformation of life is the work of God, not of human will or ingenuity, and then I'm going to come back around and say, there's some things you can do to make yourself available to that transforming power of
Well, let's talk about one of those. You have a section in your book in which you talk about the key thing to make people happy in life. And I read through it, went back through, scanned it again, looked at my notes, and I was looking for the part where you talk about getting a jet ski.
Yeah.
And that's not included in there. Because that seems like it's impossible, like the comedian says, to not smile when you're on a jet ski. But that's not the key to being happy.
Yeah.
What is?
Do
you want to, like, edit the book and include the jet ski in it? Have you been on a jet ski?
I have not been on a jet ski.
What?
But I can see the attraction of it.
When you came to Florida, we took you on a boat.
On a boat.
It was a nice boat, too.
It was. But no jet skiing was involved.
It would have changed your mind. If we would have got you a jet ski, that would have game changer.
I think, I would be kind of within the philosophical tradition here of saying that the one way to be pretty sure you're not going to be happy is to pursue happiness. Happiness is what happens when you're pursuing other things. So if somebody says to me, I really want to be happy, and I say, okay, what makes you happy? Nothing. You have any hobbies? No. I hate hobbies. You like people? No. I hate people. You like books? No. I hate books. You hate everything, but you want to be happy. I'm going to say, okay, the chances of that person achieving happiness are really low.
No, that's not happening.
Yeah. So happiness is generally a byproduct of doing other things. And I would say that as we come to desire what God desires, as we come to love the way God loves, that what happens is happiness.
Really? How does love impact our happiness, our ability to love as God loves?
Because the very nature of reality, as defined by the Trinity, is a mutual submission and self-giving. And so when we live essentially selfishly, we're out of step with the most basic reality. And so that's always going to be self-defeating.
And you mean that's how God relates to God, as in the
Correct.
Father, the Son, and the Spirit? That's
Correct.
How they interact?
Correct.
So we should model the way they interact with each other?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it's not just modeled. It's we enter into that life.
What do you mean by that?
That as we take on the manner of cruciformity, that we actually begin to experience God. And we're generally comfortable using that term, experiencing God, but we're experiencing the Trinitarian God, not just any old God.
Explain the difference between experiencing God and the Trinitarian God.
Well, when we experience the Trinitarian God, we experience the God who expresses himself in relationality and self-giving and mutual interdependence. And so as we start to live into that, we experience that reality itself. And when we do that, then we find our deepest humanity, our deepest reality. And when we don't do that, we are like a fish who says, I don't really like water.
It's kind of hard for a fish not to like water.
Right.
That's good.
So I think that, I don't want to do an attack on jet skis. Jet skis definitely have their place. I have things I like to do that that bring me joy, or at least bring me fun.
As close as you can get to joy.
Yeah, joy may be too strong a word for it. They're fun. I think there are people who would argue that the meaning of life can be found in a jet ski, but I actually don't think there are very many of them. The thought experiment we do in my classes is I give them the old thing about, let's suppose we have a pleasure machine. And by entering into this machine, some of your listeners may have seen the old movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger that got remade recently about Mars. What's the name of it? Total Recall. Okay, so where you can go into this place and they put this implant in you and you can't tell the difference in your actual experience. And and so this pleasure machine, let us suppose, does that. You can have any experience that you want by stepping into the pleasure machine, and you would not be able to tell the difference in that and something that was real. So let's suppose you've always had this great desire to, I don't know, do you like to climb mountains? You've always had this desire to climb Everest. So we can give you the experience of climbing Everest and guarantee that you won't die in the process. And
very good to
and
know.
When it's over, you won't be able to tell the difference in that memory of whether you actually climbed Everest or not. So I asked my students, okay, would you be willing to use the pleasure machine? Most of them say yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, who wouldn't? You know, I would like to hit the game-winning home run in the seventh game of the World Series.
Yes.
I want to see what that feels like. And then when I asked them, would you be willing to live in the machine? And it's really interesting. Almost none of them say yes to that.
Why is that?
Well, that's what I ask. Well, why wouldn't you? And there's something about the inauthenticity and primarily the absence of true relationship that puts them off. And so I really do think, you know, even though most of us succumb to pursuing pleasure to the point where it's unhealthy, when we really sit down and think about it, we think, okay, I want there to be more to life than just this endless succession of pleasurable moments, because that's not relational, that's not meaningful, somehow that's not real.
Yeah, that's not real.
At the end.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the importance of engaging with reality and being present with whatever your reality is right now. Which, if you're in a fake machine that's causing you to think that you're hitting the game-winning home run for the Cardinals, I'm sure that's who you'd pick to be on, that's not reality, but embracing whatever you're doing right now, that is somehow connected to the best path to get to happiness.
And there's actually some evidence on that, that what you're doing is not as important to your happiness as being fully present in the moment.
Really?
And, Harvard Science Magazine did a kind of interesting thing on that. And I'm not sure if it would hold up to really, really, you know, other sorts of lab experiments. But what they found is that people's presence in the moment was more important to their happiness than what they were actually doing.
Yeah, well, it's not a scientific study, but I can tell you most people who get home at night, surf the internet while they're watching TV, while they're checking their email at the same time, they're probably not that happy.
I would be pretty sure of that.
Yeah. And you're, what you push for is obviously, instead of this inauthentic life that is trying to be fabricated based on always having this sort of entertainment buzz, in which we're always saying something pull me out of this kind of this dull feeling I'm in right now. Give me a buzz of something, if it's news or you know, whatever.
Right.
The response is prayer, and that to learn contemplative prayer, to be present in the moment, and somehow that is how we experience reality.
I think it is. And I think again, we've talked about this before. I think technology is an issue. I'm not as anti-technology as, say, Martin Heidegger was. But I do think...
Well, that's good to know.
technology makes it difficult for us to be fully present to the people in front of us and fully present to God.
Yeah.
Because we create a culture of distraction.
Yeah.
And that learning, when you are fully present in the moment, what you find out is that God will meet you there.
Yeah, and as you say in the book, forms are not neutral.
Correct. They're doing something.
Yeah. But the form of a podcast, that's a really good thing. That's positive. That's good for you.
No doubt.
Podcast sounds very positive. Basically the same word.
Yeah.
I think the etymology is very interconnected in the Latin.
I didn't take Latin. I'll have to take your word for it.
You know, I messed up Latin when I was talking to Pete Rollins two podcasts ago, so I can go ahead and mess up Latin right now. Anyway, Randy, thank you so much for your time.
Yep.
I would encourage everyone to get a copy of your book. All your books are probably on Amazon where they can get them downloaded.
They are.
Read them. And
what's the title of the book again?
It is titled, well, it's a series of trolls. I don't have any idea. I'm looking, God at Work is one of them.
Life Work.
Life Work. Well, there's a stack of them right there. Yeah. I can tell you a lot about your book, but I can't I can give you the seven things you need to be a decent Samaritan, or the five points about being a cruciform person. But titles, no, I don't know those. Yeah,
but they're actually going to buy the book. They probably need the...
I'll link it.
The title.
It'll be linked on the site.
All right.
So you're good to go. Hey, thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.